The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Our guest this week is journalist Nikki Wolfe. Hello, Nikki.
Hi there.
Now, Nikki is editor of New Statesman America. He also previously wrote for The Guardian. And on his bio, he puts that he is not Harry Styles' dad.
Yeah.
It strikes me that that's exactly what Harry Styles' dad would say.
Well, that is because I did once, one of my first weekends in New York, I managed to convince a bar full of people that I was Harry Styles' dad, and then got free drinks every time I went back to that bar and started to feel quite guilty about it after a little while.
So it's just guilt.
It's just guilt,
that has prevented you from doing it. Right. We'll come on to talk about America, but first, the news in Britain. And inevitably, of course, we have to start with Brexit. And good news, Marie, it looks like we may be headed for a delay. This week, Yvette Cooper's amendment was defeated. That would have postponed Brexit if no deal was reached by the 26th of February. But a delay now seems more likely. Sir Graham Brady has said that he could accept a delay, and Jeremy Hunt has said that extra time will be needed. And we all know what follows extra time: penalties. And of course, the Germans winning. Nikki, can you see this carrying on forever?
Yeah.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks for coming.
It's so bleak, isn't it? And it's just like, I mean, I've essentially moved to Trump's America to escape Brexit, which says something about how comparatively dismal the two stories are.
But I feel like, so I was talking to a friend who's a journalist in the US, and she was arguing that at least there, it's like a different mad thing every day.
Yeah.
So at least you know that Brexit is the same mad thing.
But there's an end in sight. Like someone was saying that, so there's a lot of kind of comparison chat that you do between Trump and Brexit about who's his worst. And the answer that I found very difficult to come back to when Americans say that Britain's crisis is worse than America's crisis is that America's crisis very much has an end. I mean, Trump might win another term. But unless he sort of suspends elections and then we're all in reasonably serious trouble...
Are we completely ruling that out?
No, not necessarily completely ruling that out. But it is much more unlikely than Brexit just will collapse on a rolling crisis for the rest of our lives. We'll always be talking about Brexit. Every podcast everyone will ever do will start with, and first, Brexit.
Like the 1966 World Cup and international football.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, to briefly come back to the question you asked originally about 20 minutes ago, you know, I said it last week and I'll say it again, I do think that it will probably, you know, be extended until at least the 1st of July. After that, it will be hard because what do we do with the MEPs? Like, there might be some sort of fudge we can work on. I'm not sure that's what we need right now. But at least, yeah, I think early July is likely.
And as debate about a delay carries on, we've had the announcement that the parliamentary recess has been cancelled. MPs were set to be away from the Commons from the week commencing the 18th of February, but they now have to stay in Parliament. But Commons leader Andrea Leadsom has trolled everyone by announcing an entirely Brexit-free programme that week. I'm not suggesting that all MPs had booked skiing holidays, but should they have this time off?
But I think that was such a weird thing. A, I will, like, not to sound like PR for the MPs, but I genuinely think, you know, quite a lot of Labour MPs especially did make the case that actually recess a lot of the time is just people going back to their constituencies and actually doing constituency work. Mostly, I think, in this context, that they've just not had the time to do.
Yeah, it's the only, only time of the parliamentary year when they do get to do actual constituency work because of everything that's going on in Parliament.
No, exactly. But that being said, I think it's such a weird thing. So they cancel recess. As far as I can tell, there's only a one-line whip that week. So actually, the MPs didn't really have to be on the estate. There's not going to be any sort of like major legislation being voted through. And the at least the Tory chief whip messaged Tory MPs to say, oh, if you had like family or friends like commitments, basically, it's fine, like we'll write you a note. And it's like, okay, so in what way is this not recess then?
Like, Nikki, is this just PR?
There is something to be said for the fact that there's something quite important going on, isn't there? But then again, if everyone's, all anyone's doing is playing for time, so...
If you're running down the clock, you may as well run down the clock on the Alps.
Yeah, although I'm quite enjoying the idea of Jeremy Corbyn on a skiing holiday. It's like, kind of does not compute, does it?
Oh my God, John McDonnell just looking furious going down the slopes.
Straight down, see the no turns.
I do wonder which of the Labour and Conservative front benches can ski, because...
I bet Tom Watson can ski.
That's a good question.
He's wearing ski goggles most of the time, isn't he?
If you know the answer to this, or if you are Jeremy Corbyn and you can tell us whether you like these things, let us know.
I'm trying to think. I think the problem is that that's really indicative, I think, of a bigger problem. Like, it is taking me a lot of mental energy to try and remember everyone in the shadow cabinet. I used to know, but I think, you know, like, we talk about them so little these days. I'm like, who's what again? Who's...
And speaking of the cold... Unilever has said that it is stockpiling Magnum ice creams ahead of the UK's possible departure from the European Union. Magnum's the world's most powerful ice cream. Chief executive Alain Juppé, or Alain Jope, not sure how you pronounced it.
Was that an attempt at French?
I don't know how you pronounce it. J-O-P-E.
Oh, yeah. Jope.
Well, that's much better.
The same as he did it, just with a little eyebrow raise.
So, Alain.
Yeah, that's French.
Al from Unilever has said the company was holding a few weeks' worth of extra stocks in case of disruption. It's snowing outside. What does a few weeks' worth of stocks of Magnums look like at this time of year?
So I'm really into it because, when was it? I think last winter I went a bit mad when the winter would not stop. And so I started putting the heating all the way up in my flat and I'd just be in bed eating ice cream and watching movies. So again...
I feel like this is an art installation protesting against the state of British politics. That's what it sounds like.
Basically, so yeah, lost it slightly. But as a result, I ate so much ice cream in the winter that by the time summer came, I was like, I'm genuinely just very sick of ice cream, and then got back into it in the winter. So this is good. This is good for me personally. Therefore, it's good in general.
Well, it does raise a wider question about firms confirming that they have stockpiled some things for Brexit. Nikki, are you stockpiling anything?
I mean, I'm looking forward to coming back for Brexit with a whole bunch of $1 bills and suddenly being the most wealthy person in the country.
Marie, what about you? What are you stockpiling?
I also have like €250 in cash, so basically I will be buying your house very soon. I'm not sure what I could fucking vaping now, so I might just like a massive, gigantic dweeb like stockpile. Can't even bring myself to say it. E-cigarette liquid. But yeah, no, I'm not sure. It's fine. I can cook. I like the idea. I like the challenge, you know, of like having to cook with whatever's left. Like
having to hunt your own food.
Well, in many ways, you know, when I sort of like come home from the pub a bit pissed and like on the way back, I'm like, shit, there's nothing in my fridge, I'd forgotten. And you sort of go to the corner shop and you're like, what can I buy to make a meal out of this?
If dystopian films and literature have taught us anything, I think it's that we all need friends in the countryside who run farms who we can just walk to in desolate times.
I mean, didn't Charles Moore essentially say that we're all going to be smuggling lettuce on little boats like Dunkirk? Did you ever see this column?
Yeah, if you're going to smuggle stuff, why lettuce? We don't need lettuce anyway. Ban lettuce. That's my Brexit song.
Lettuce uses up quite a lot of space for very few calories, I think.
Although maybe it floats, so maybe you can expand the boat with like pontoons of lettuce and then put other things on it.
And yet this is one of the things that just isn't being discussed in the current Brexit debate.
The spectators are asking the big questions.
In other news, Fiona Onasanya has been sentenced to 3 months in prison for lying to police about a speeding ticket. Previously, she had said in a message to Labour MPs, I'm in good biblical company along with Joseph, Moses, Daniel and his three Hebrew friends who were each found guilty by the courts of their day. Of course, this is equally true of Christ, who was accused and convicted by the courts of his day. Not of speeding. From what I understand, however, she has said, so far at least, that she will not be resigning. She will be keeping her job and, of course, keeping her salary while in prison, though she could be recalled some months down the line, although it's a slightly complicated process. Marie, should she be resigning?
I think she should, but I actually like, I didn't know about this, but turns out that as an MP, you can get convicted of a crime and go to prison and remain an MP. I think you have...
12 months.
So 12 months. Yeah. So I love the idea of like whoever like devised that line. We're like, okay, so MPs can do little crimes, just a bit of crime and they can remain MPs. But, you know, bigger crimes, no. But I like the idea that, you know, yeah, that they've got that space to be like, you know, if you just want to get involved in like the smaller side of crime,
if it's for your own,
fine.
If the crime is for your own personal use...
No, exactly.
Or like ginormous crime. The reverse bell curve of crime. Like, you can do the huge crimes or the tiny crimes, but not like the medium crimes. Like,
that's
murder.
How I live my life as well. So, yeah.
I mean, 12 months is the limit. I think you can fit quite a lot under 12 months, particularly for sort of white collar crime. Do we think she'll be recalled if she doesn't resign? Do you think the process is yet developed enough? I mean, in the States, there's a well-trodden route for recalling elected representatives. But in this country, although it's been introduced, it hasn't been used much. Can you see it happening?
Yes, but also, I don't know, I'm basically saying this because I really want there to be a by-election because Peterborough is a marginal. I think we need a good by-election. It will distract us a tiny bit from Brexit.
But a few months down the line is like 2-3 general elections time anyway, isn't it?
We do not say the words.
What a lovely, lovely thought. We're joined now for our weekly chat with Sarbjit from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hi there.
So we're going to go through a whole host of stuff today as there's loads of possible things swirling around. Let's start with the main question, Brexit. Do we have a market on when we will leave and what is it showing?
So we do have a market on when the UK will officially leave the EU. It's been going, obviously, for a long time now. We've seen changes in the last month, really, that has really kind of shaken things up. The favourite January to April has dropped down to 30%. And May, August 2019 has gone up to 35%. So this is the first time that the favourite isn't been January, April 2019. So as it gets closer, people don't believe that's actually going to happen now.
So increasingly, people are expecting an extension of some kind.
Yeah, a few months extension. There's been a lot of talk from the Labour benches about how long that extension would be. And obviously, the Cooper Amendment would have given an extension or given a scope for an extension. But it's not really reflected on our market. The defeat of that bill in the House of Commons hasn't reflected. People still think May to August is the most likely outcome.
Inevitably, then, that leads to the question about Theresa May's exit date, as that may be closely tied. What are the markets showing on that?
That's showing 2019 as a strong favourite, 61%. 2020 is the next one at 21%. And they're the two really in contention. 2019 contract's been rising throughout the whole year, and that's the clear favourite.
So she's a dead woman walking. It's just she's walking quite slowly.
I seem to have a sense of déjà vu about this.
I may have made that joke before.
But more that she doesn't seem to be able to leave or to recognise defeat when it's staring in her face. So she's there for now. 2019 is the strongest favourite, and that's what the market is saying.
Well, if nothing else, you do have to admire her resilience. If she were ever to leave, there's the question about who would be the next Tory leader. Now, this is a market we've been following closely over the last few weeks, and there's been a lot of movement consistently. What's it showing most recently?
So most recently, Michael Gove is back on top with last trade price around 16%, now on 17%. Boris Johnson is at 14%. So Michael Gove has been on top since about mid-January onwards and is staying in position. Boris Johnson has also stayed in where he has. No one's really trading him at the moment. Sajid Javid, number three, but he's been dropping off recently. And then you've got Dominic Raab and Jeremy Hunt bringing up the back.
Now, one of the things that's been discussed in the context of Brexit quite a lot is the question of another general election. I don't think it's likely this year, but what do the markets say?
The markets say 2019 at 37%, 2020 at 17%, and 2022 at 34%. So it's either 2019 or 2022 according to our market. But these are not much in it, 3%. So it could be either of them, really.
Yeah, broadly divided. Yeah. Do the markets have a sense on what the result of the next election might be whenever that happens? The polling's quite clear and shows that a majority of people think that it would be a hung parliament. What about the markets?
So we have a party to win the most parliamentary seats. So the Conservatives currently trading, the prices are 49%, Labour at 48%. It's so close. It's so close that it's really hard to tell who's going to get even one more seat than the other.
And of course, a lot could happen between now and whenever that election takes place, particularly, of course, if it's 2022. We could all be eating grass by then. We're discussing this week the United States and all the issues surrounding that. What are your most popular markets when it comes to our friends over the pond?
Well, we've got a number of markets around the US scene. We've got the one around impeachment for Donald Trump in the House of Representatives, where we're showing that no is the most likely outcome there, that he won't get impeached by the House of Representatives. That's trading at 61%. We've got Donald Trump to serve his first full term as president. So will he actually make it to the end of it and not resign, not anything else happen to him? And that's trading at 69% to say yes, he will do it. And then obviously we're looking at who might challenge him, who might be the Democratic Party representative as well. There's been a lot of talk about Kamala Harris. She's leading the market at 22%, following her Joe Biden at 14%.
And Joe Biden hasn't declared yet, so there could be a bump for him if he decides to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been on the cards for a while. He's been kind of making moves in that way, but not formally declared. Beto O'Rourke is in third place. And then we have Bernie Sanders at 10%. So Kamala Harris, for what it's worth, at this stage in the race, is the clear favourite to become the Democratic nominee. But you've got some strong contenders there who haven't really announced their plans or what they're going to do. So I would expect that market to change.
A lot still to play for.
Yes, definitely.
Sajit, thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly. And it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole. Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Nikki, you are involved with New Statesman America.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So, the New Statesman is launched in the United States. We're looking to do a sort of a mix of. So, the good thing about having an operation like that is you can then do the kind of transatlantic arbitrage. So, you can explain Brexit to Americans, explain Trump to British people, and then also do kind of America focused content that ideally both Brits and Americans would want to read.
And you studied in the US?
So I did my master's in New York and was with The Guardian in the US for 3 years before that.
What sent you over there in the first place?
I first moved to the US in 2012 to cover the presidential election that year, which was, God, I mean, the time when Mitt Romney was like...
I miss Mitt.
With his binders full of women.
With his binders full of women. And the 47% comment basically cost him the election. He was never really going to win that election, but he must be looking back now being like, what? All I had to do was just deny it.
Do we remember that mad story about how he was driving? I can't remember the details, but I think he was going on a holiday with his family, you're coming back, and they forgot the dog on the roof.
No, not forgot the dog on the roof. Everywhere he went with the dog. That's how he transported his dog.
Oh, yes.
It was on the roof.
I love that story so much. It's so weird. Such a weird
thing. In a box or just sort of hanging on for dear life?
So... in a box, but like in a cage?
In a cage on the roof.
So it was kind of buffeted, like not in an enclosed, in like a roof, just basically on the roof rack.
There was the brilliant moment in the Mitt Romney documentary as well, where he tries to iron his suit while wearing it.
Oh my God.
And it's the brilliant thing of he's putting the iron on his arm going, ow, ow,
such an
ow.
Alien.
He's such a weird dude. I find him
like
weirdly
him so
endearing.
Much. Yeah. That year, a friend of mine and I went out in Washington, D.C. for Halloween dressed as Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. And D.C. is such a political Halloween costumesy place that people were like, oh, that's a great Tag Romney costume. I like, thought I was being more granular than just being Mitt Romney. And there were three different people in that bar all dressed as binders full of women.
Oh, wow.
It's very high concept.
Sounds amazing. Inevitably, of course, though, when we're talking about news in America at the moment, our attention must turn to whether the Rams should be in the Super Bowl, given that it was clear pass interference against New Orleans.
Yes.
This is ridiculous.
That was a bad call, and I'm a huge Saints fan because I used to live in New Orleans for a bit. Then again, at this point, I'll support anyone
against but the Patriots.
Well, yeah.
Of course. I mean, that goes without saying. But New Orleans, I think New Orleans would have stood a better chance than the Rams.
And Drew Brees is amazing. And New Orleans has got a really good story. Like, they're kind of the comeback after Hurricane Katrina.
2,000 years later.
But I have a feeling that a lot of this is going to be edited out. So let's move on and talk instead about the relationship between Britain and America and how things are with Trump. Now, 61% of Brits see the US as our closest ally. 55% of Americans consider the UK an ally. That's joint highest with Canada. What's your take on the relationship now between Britain and America?
I mean, that is a very illustrative statistic there, isn't it? That's like 62% consider this person your girlfriend. And then she's like, I consider you a person. Like, an ally is really Britain. So that means 45% of America don't even consider Britain an ally.
There was a range, and so they could be a friend, but not necessarily an ally. The question wording was
right. Just friends.
My liking, but there you go.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the differences between what Britain is to Americans, and because of the shared language, there's a lot of kind of closeness between Brits individually and Americans individually. But whether the government, and especially the Trump administration, really considers Britain in that kind of way, Almost certainly not. I mean, I'd be amazed if Trump really... Trump doesn't know what Brexit is. He doesn't know what the...
You know, like, the story I absolutely love is that, so, Jeremy Hunt, as Foreign Sec, went to the US and I think did some big interview with Fox. And apparently, Trump watched it and went up to, like, Kelly and was like, who was that? He was very good.
Well, that's promising. I mean, that's...
And it's, yeah, I mean, kind of swings and roundabouts, really.
It's probably then, just his accent that he liked.
But then we're in the problematic point of if we use Brexit as leverage to gain a good relationship with the Trump administration, then the incoming, presumably, touch wood, Democratic administration is then identifies the British government as being Brexity Trump. But do we try and identify with the Democrats at this point and risk Trump just absolutely shitting all over us?
Well, I mean, historically in this country, we've always, as a nation, tended to side with the Democrats. And so consistently, when you run questions saying, if you had a vote, who would you vote for? The Democrat, whoever it is, will get sort of 85-90%. The Republican will get 10-15%.
Yeah.
But then I think what's really interesting in that kind of dynamic is that under the kind of like Cameron and Osborne years, there were definitely like quite close to Democrats, obviously different because Obama was in power, but still there were clearly A, people who I think deeply cared about US politics, and B, were kind of very sort of like Democrat-y. But Theresa May's administration is not the same. So I think she went to speak at a sort of like, I can remember, I think it was like a state Republican gathering last year, I believe, or like a bit longer than that. So like clearly that tie doesn't exist anymore. Like it's a, you know, with a different flavour, I guess, of Conservative Party in power.
I always got the impression that George Osborne and David Cameron et al. Grew up devouring the West Wing. Mm. I don't get that impression about Theresa May. I don't think she watched it. She probably doesn't watch TV.
What did Theresa May grow up devouring then? I mean,
like some really boring books. But not even, because actually she doesn't really strike me as a bookworm. I'm not.
I think she just sits in the... She just sat in the corner.
That's the like saddest story about Theresa May when she was a kid, wasn't it? That her parents didn't want her to join the Conservative Party. And so in secret, she went to her local association to stuff envelopes at like 16. That's what she did behind her parents' backs.
So rather than watching the West Wing, she was stuffing envelopes for the Conservatives.
I mean, there is something to be said for the idea that the West Wing has done extraordinary damage to an entire generation of young left-wing people, and that they've come into politics with this idealism that reaching out to the other side and soaring speeches and all of this stuff is exactly what you need in politics. And it's just, it's ironed out all of the cynicism in a whole generation of operatives, and so they just lose. And this is what you get, the people who are like the Pod Save America types, who just don't know.
Pod Save America, for our listeners, is the podcast run by Jon Favreau, Tommy Vietor, and John Lovett, who were three operatives within the Obama White House.
It worked during the Obama administration, but also it meant that the Obama administration missed a fair few kind of open goals. I mean, especially in the first 2 years of the administration, when they had both houses of Congress, there was such an opportunity to just ram some stuff through. And instead, they kept reaching out to the other side with this idea that, you know, later on... And instead, Mitch McConnell just took and took and took and took. And then as soon as they were in power in the Senate, it was like, no, not giving you any judges, not giving you any legislation, nothing. Like, as if they'd rammed something through anyways.
But I think in the UK, we've kind of had the opposite where... And that's obviously a newer generation, but
we've
clearly...
We've had the thick of it.
The thick of it, exactly. And then obviously you have so many people who seem to assume that basically the way to do politics is to be entirely cynical and not really care about anything and, like, just plot a lot, just plot all the time and also be really shouty at people. And it's like, that doesn't work either. Like, there should be a sort of thing where, like, if you watch one, you have to watch the other, both preferably at the same time, and then go, okay, aim for something in the middle if you want to get in this.
I do have a sense that there's a real problem that some senior people in British politics believed, or at least believed in the past, that the West Wing basically was a documentary. And so to deal with the Americans, you needed to address them in the way that that show played out. That hasn't seemed to have been hugely successful in either the Obama administration or the Trump administration.
Although, so the Democrats have finally, in this new Congress that's come in, seem to have worked out how to do opposition, which is a kind of the sort of two-pronged approach that the Republicans have been doing, which is you have the kind of actual power base led by Nancy Pelosi just absolutely stonewalling, and then you've got the kind of outriders led by Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez who are just taking pot shots all the time. And it's driving Trump mad. It's absolutely fantastic to watch.
And he doesn't really know how to deal with either Pelosi or Cortez.
No, he's got no clue. And I think it's no accident. It's probably just because they're both women and he's really not used to women in positions of power.
I absolutely, like, there's nothing I've been loving more in the past few weeks than like Republicans keeping like trying to own AOC. And each time just failing so hard because she just becomes like cooler, more relatable with each thing. And it's like, please continue forever because this is a joy to watch.
Yeah, like that dancing video. And it was like kind of a weird, obscure, it wasn't like a Republican Party attack. It was some obscure Twitter account posted this video implying that Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez wasn't suited for government because she'd done this video in college, I think, where she was dancing. And they posted the video, and it's just the coolest thing you've ever seen.
People who dance in college.
But not even, it's not even like lame college.
But
that is
the Breakfast Club. So they redid the Breakfast Club dancing thing.
Oh,
and
right.
It's like, okay, so like great like pop culture reference, which you know a lot of people will have seen. She looks fantastic. She looks like she's having fun with her friends. And it's like, and that is bad. Okay, right.
And this, of course, leads us inevitably to a discussion about the shutdown. And now the shutdown has, of course, now itself been shut down, if only temporarily. Explain to us, what is a government shutdown in the US sense? What would it, and what would the equivalent look like in the UK?
So the difference between the US and the UK is that the branches of government are separated out. So the executive, which in the UK is the Prime Minister and her cabinet, which all come from the legislature, is separate. So in order for the president to run the federal government, which is the executive branch, which includes sort of everything from the National Park Service to the branches of the military to, you know, the Coast Guard and everything else besides, the legislature has to pass a regular set of budgets in order to give them the money to do that. So the Congress holds the purse strings. And when there's a clash between the executive and the legislature over the contents, so the president will come and present his budget and then the Congress has to pass it. And in this case, Trump presented a budget which included $6 billion to pay for his border wall.
Which Mexico is going to pay for.
Which he said Mexico was going to pay for the whole way through the campaign. And then, so Nancy Pelosi, who's now newly minted Speaker of the House, said essentially, no. And then there was this weird clash on Capitol Hill where Trump said, you know what, during a shutdown, everyone is like pointing fingers. That's how it traditionally goes. But Trump cracked really quickly and said, you know what, yeah, I'm proud to shut the government down over this border wall. And you could see the looks on Chuck Schumer, who's the minority leader in the Senate, and Nancy Pelosi's face just going, ah, I can't believe he actually said that. And then just ever since that point, like on a day-by-day basis, as more people, you know, garbage piled up in the streets, as, and then especially towards the end. I mean, the thing that really ended it, ironically, because Reagan brought down the Air Traffic Controllers Union, suddenly the air traffic controllers, traffic started to pile up at airports.
At LaGuardia,
and then Newark and JFK, and Trump caved in moments.
Yeah, in the polling, 38% of Americans credit Trump with ending the shutdown, compared to 25% who say it was Pelosi's influence, but only 7% think that Trump got what he wanted from the shutdown. That includes only 12% of Republicans. 40% think the Democrats got what they wanted. But of course, this is only a temporary thing. There has been discussion of emergency powers and a state of emergency being declared in order to get the border wall built. Can you see that happening?
Yeah, I mean, that's totally within something that Trump would think he would do, except he'll have lost interest by then and have moved on to something else. I think Trump is no more attached to the border wall than he is to any other of his bonkers ideas. It just started out as a call and response thing. Someone on American TV recently said that the wall was basically Trump's free bird. It was the one that, you know, people would go to his rallies and be like, do the wall. And he'd be like, what are we going to build? He'd be like, the wall. But he doesn't really care in any meaningful sense. I mean, you know, all of his...
What does Trump care about?
Just Trump.
Right.
He's a very simple sort of call and response machine. He cares about people clapping and cheering for him. He cares about being scared of when people will boo him.
Same. Aren't we all like that?
But it's very
aren't
easy.
We all Trump? The polling politics.
Deep down, we're all Trump.
But you can see moments where, like, a journalist will ask him a question. And I think this is a good example of this. Someone, a reporter at one of his press conferences, said, are you considering using emergency powers to build your wall? And you could see him go, well, I wasn't, but now I am.
Emergency powers, you
yeah.
say?
It's like, stop asking him these questions. He's not going to Google this. He doesn't know that that's within his purview.
Mr. President, will it be using the force to build this wall?
No, but like, it's to the point where... If someone would stand up and go, Mr. President, congratulations, like you're getting loads and loads, like everyone loves your Medicare for All policy. He'd be like, oh yeah, we're doing Medicare for All? And then you've just built an NHS in America.
Well, there's a very obvious solution then. Why doesn't someone stand up and say, Mr. President, I visited your wall today. It was magnificent. Congratulations on that.
There is no way that wouldn't work.
Like so many things on this show, that's an idea we have now copyrighted. So take that, Pod Save America. What now, though, for the Democrats? The runners and riders are beginning to emerge. Do they have someone that can win the presidency? Do they have someone that can win in Pennsylvania?
I mean, all of the polling that's come out show that so far they don't have anyone that would lose. Trump polls against every declared Democrat and sort of a dozen non-declared Democrats, Trump polls in the early 40s. So there's a couple of interesting candidates. Kamala Harris seems to be the most like proper, well-rounded, actual candidate of them all. Elizabeth Warren is also very good, although there's a lot of feeling that she might have missed her. When you're on kind of a perfect run in American politics, you kind of have to grab the ball and go.
One of the things we know about polling for candidates is that when they announce, they get a big boost.
Mm.
And some, very few, can carry that through. Others just drop right back.
So the useful metric, though, with Kamala Harris is that other than Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, there's no other Democratic candidate. And Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is obviously not a candidate, not eligible for another 6 years, because the presidency is the only office in America with a minimum age requirement of 35.
A minimum, but not a maximum.
Not a maximum. And that's the one you kind of really need. Other than Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, no Democrat has nearly as much Twitter engagement as Kamala Harris. And that's sort of like a rolling poll with a really big sample size in some ways.
And she's a former lawyer. She was heavily involved with the issues over Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court. And so she has that visibility factor.
Yes. So she's the senator from California. She's done a lot of really good work in Senate committee. She's a former prosecutor. Now, like old American doctrine would say that out of the two different types of court lawyer you can be, which is a prosecutor or defender, it's better to have been a prosecutor because in campaigns people come after you for, you know, defending murderers and letting criminals go free otherwise. That doctrine seems to be slightly in question now because people are questioning her prosecutorial record, saying, you know, she put away quite a lot of people of color on quite minor offenses. Now, that is part of the job of prosecutor. But that might be something of an albatross around her neck.
But isn't she as well? And I feel like obviously that's more like kind of for the left of the Democrats as opposed to everyone else. But there's stuff like Sesta Foster, her massive role like in this, which obviously was like massively controversial. And yeah, and I think people kept talking. So I think there was stuff around trans rights as well she wasn't great on. Mm. There was, and obviously, yeah, her career as a prosecutor, there's quite a lot of stuff where she was clearly like tough on law and order. So like, do you think she could actually get selected as a candidate? Because like, admittedly, I think that the people I follow on Twitter and I kind of like see their opinions in the Democrats are probably skewed towards like the left of the party. But so do you think she could have the numbers, even though I think, yeah, she is quite controversial among the more left?
I mean, so the problem with how this primary is going to play out is that after the Bernie Sanders debacle in 2016, there was a lot of outcry about how the primaries worked.
Specifically with regards to superdelegates.
Specifically both with regards to superdelegates and with regards to the state being winner-take-all. So there were a lot of states which were very close, but which, because Hillary won by, you know, 2, 3, 4 percentage points, she got all of the delegates from that state. Now, they've changed that in a lot of, if not all, states this time. So it's possible to see, especially with a field this crowded, because everyone sees that Trump is very kind of beatable, you might end up with a sort of mirror image version of the Republican primary in 2016. 17, 18, 19 candidates, and no one really... All polling at 5%. And then that is a situation which kind of encourages the slightly more wacky candidates to stand out because they're the ones that are getting all of the media attention. On the other hand, because a lot of the states are proportionally allocated, it's hard to see how that plays out. Because on the one hand, that might mean that you end up getting all the way to the convention and no one's got enough delegates to break through. On the other hand, that means if you get to the convention and everyone's horse trading and wanting to everyone to pledge their delegates to them, it might encourage the candidates to be nicer to each other because they might want their delegates down the line. So it's kind of difficult to know how that's going to play out.
If you were a Democratic strategist, would you say it was better to have a man or woman up against Trump, all other things remaining equal?
It depends on the individual candidate. I think for narrative reasons, it would be like the perfect ending to this would be Trump being beaten by a woman, right? Like that's how we want it to end. If the polling suggests that America's got a better chance of getting rid of him with someone like Sherrod Brown, the populist Democratic senator from Ohio, just won his re-election by 16 points, which is 10 points clear of the Ohio polling. If he's more likely to beat Trump, you have to ask yourself, do we want to win it the way we want, or do we want to guarantee it?
But do you think Kamala Harris would stand a better chance against Trump if she was a man?
The problem with Kamala Harris is, not the problem with Kamala Harris, but a problem that she would face if she was the candidate, is more that she's from California than anything else. People in the Midwest, California has become like a stick to beat the Democratic Party with. So if you see in Texas, people were saying that Beto O'Rourke was coming here with his California values and all that kind of, and you see that kind of thing a lot. So I think Californian might be almost as big an impediment to Harris as as anything else.
My last question then is about Bernie Sanders. Will he figure next time around, having had such an interesting ride last time?
Yeah, certainly. And he's got staff in Iowa, he's got staff in New Hampshire, he's definitely thinking about it. The California primary is earlier this year, so the kind of small states of Iowa and New Hampshire don't quite have so much weight. So the other thing that's changed is this kind of California being, I think it's now the sixth primary, so it's possible for a candidate with big kind of backing, like someone like Kamala Harris or Liz Warren, to say, you know, I'm not even really going to bother with New Hampshire and Iowa. So you kind of don't have that retail politics which favours the smaller candidates anymore.
Elizabeth Warren, fuck Iowa.
Yeah. Elizabeth Warren's got more stuff in Iowa than anyone else, but, you know, like a Joe Biden could theoretically get in before California and ignore the smaller states.
I think we're forgetting that we are currently living in the cursed timeline. And so true, I think the Democratic primaries are going to be Bernie and Hillary.
Oh, God. Hillary.
That would be the most cursed scenario. Therefore, will happen.
an interesting thought. If you had to narrow your colours to the mast, who's going to win the Democratic nomination?
I would say Kamala Harris at this point, probably.
No, not at this point.
I think still Kamala Harris. She's got the best chance.
Elizabeth Warren? You can feel the conviction in my voice.
That is how most people say Elizabeth Warren now.
And I'm not going to. I never make predictions and I never will. Now, both of you two live abroad, in a sense, from your home countries. Where do you think Brits would choose to live abroad? If given the choice, any country in the world, where would Brits most likely to be choose to live abroad?
I mean, after 29, they're not going to have that many options, are they? Especially like Devon, Scotland.
The question is, if you had the opportunity, would you or would you not want to live and or work in any of the following countries? Which country do you think came top?
That is a genuinely interesting question, because I have no idea.
Well, thank you. I put in a lot of effort. Spain. No, you'd be surprised.
The US?
Relatively quite far down. US, there are six countries higher than the US.
Australia?
Is it some, like, sunny country?
Sometimes. Certainly not at the moment. Australia? No. Australia actually is...
Is it France? Plot twist.
No, it's... actually, Australia isn't in the list.
No.
What a...
Suck it, Australia.
Poor question wording here. Top of the list, Canada.
Really?
Yeah, Canada, the polite version of the US, followed by New Zealand. Then in terms of European countries, and it's quite a drop down from Canada and New Zealand. Next one is Sweden, Netherlands, Switzerland, Italy, and the United States.
I like that France does not even feature.
Oh, right, no, France.
Switzerland. More people want to live in Switzerland than in the US.
Than in France. More people,
only by 1%. Only by 1%. But you have a larger number of people who don't want to live in the US. And so you have objections to that. France is just above Germany, just below Spain. So it comes right in the middle. Beats Portugal, Malta. Luxembourg, Cyprus, and bottom of the list, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
Wow.
More people would want to live in Russia than want to live in Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, or Egypt.
Oh, I'd quite like to live in Turkey. Yeah, well, not right now. I feel like it's not super chilled right now, but in general, as a country.
Of the EU countries, which do you think is the least popular?
Belgium.
No.
Somewhere random like Slovenia?
No, actually, Slovenia, weirdly popular. There are six EU countries less popular than Slovenia.
And it's going to be like an obscure one that nobody knows.
No.
Is it France?
No.
Yes.
I've told you.
Like Norway? No, Norway's not in.
No, least popular.
Least popular.
Think east.
Romania?
Yes, Romania. Just below Lithuania, Latvia and Bulgaria.
Cool.
But then
no pattern there.
Yes. Poland, Hungary, Slovenia, all better. Okay, that's it for this week. Nikki, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Are off on recess next week, but we shall be back soon. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Smarkets. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podotpods.com.